Hello, everyone, and welcome to In Conversation with Heartlines, a show where we try and help you do what's right so that you can begin to fix the things that are wrong. I'm your host, Brett Fish Anderson, and today we are diving into a giant of a topic that we will not come close to being fully covered in one episode, but we're going to at least get started. And that topic is going beyond 16 days, how to make meaningful change in eradicating GBV, GBVF, which is gender-based violence and femicide, and also violence against women and children. Gender-based violence or violence against women and children is a shadow that looms over way too many lives in our country and around the world. And it's not just physical abuse, but emotional, psychological, and even economic abuse. And there are various initiatives to raise awareness and advocacy, but what will make them more effective? And what will it take to really see the scourge overthrown? And then how do we empower survivors to overcome fear? Fear of judgment, fear of retaliation, and especially the fear of not being believed. And then what can we do as ordinary citizens to play our part? Let's dive right in.
A values-based life starts here.
Today we are in conversation with Marisha Singh-Naika, who is a family therapist, an advocate for social justice, and a Heartlines rep. Please introduce yourself to the listeners and maybe give us some kind of understanding as to why this topic speaks so strongly to you.
Thank you, Brett. Hello to the listeners as well. I'm grateful to be here today to be talking, like you said, about this topic where there is so much to be done and so much to be said about it. Personally, it is important for me because I am a survivor of gender-based violence. And whether it has happened to you directly, we do know that almost everybody that you do speak to has been affected by GBV in some way or the other.
Yeah, Marisha, thank you for that. And really, I love the work you do in this space. So it's really good to be speaking to you today. I think what will be helpful is if we can kickstart the show by trying to kind of get an understanding of what exactly is gender-based violence. What's been surprising to me in various spaces where we do Heartlines work is that sometimes I'll say GBV and people won't even know what the definition means. What does it mean and how has the definition or maybe the understanding of it grown over the years?
Gender-based violence is not your typical type of violence, and I'll explain why. It's violence involving people, both men, women, children, in a way in which the victim or the survivor is affected or targeted because of their gender and because of unequal or harmful gender norms and gender roles. So there's unequal power relationships usually between the perpetrator and the survivor. And in our country, it is usually women more the survivors and victims of gender-based violence. And unfortunately, we have many men who are the perpetrators of gender-based violence and femicide in South Africa. And why I say it's a different type of violence, because this violence has been normalized. So when you talk about it, or when you share about it, or when we hear about it, it's another story. It's a woman has been raped. Often we'll be, okay, we've heard that before. It happens every day. That's the norm. Also, it's a violence where the survivors or the victims are blamed, more especially for the violence happening to them. That's what makes it very unique. It's either, for example, if a survivor has been raped, it will be around the question of, oh, where was she? Why was she wearing that? She had too much to drink. So this type of violence is unique in that way. It's normalized, and often the victims are blamed for the violence that is perpetrated against them.
Sure, Marisha, thank you. I think that just that idea of it being normalized is so horrifying. And I think the other word that comes to mind for me is desensitized, that kind of when you spoke, oh, it's just another rape. It's because the statistics are so high in our country, it's easy to get, I guess, in a way, overwhelmed. And maybe part of it is kind of protecting ourselves because it's just so overwhelming that how do you even face that thing? But it really is a tragedy that it is so commonplace that it doesn't shock us. It doesn't horrify us as much as it should. And maybe that's part of, if it continued to do that, maybe we would all be a bit more focused on ending it. And then you spoke about the victim or the survivor being blamed, that there's that sense of misdirection where all the questions tend to be about the woman. And we don't teach boys to not rape. We teach girls to not be put into these situations where rape can happen. And that is a huge part of it. You also spoke about kind of gender gender norms and roles, this traditional stuff, this learnt understanding of men and women, boys and girls, and how so much of that plays into the stories that play out. And so it feels, in a sense, like there's this overwhelming amount of work that has to be done to kind of get past that. But in addition to that, what are some of the greatest contributing factors, in your opinion, to gender-based violence in South Africa in terms of what you've come across?
Some of the biggest contributors or key drivers of gender-based violence would have to start with gender inequality. So the unequal power relations that exist between men and women, but also between men, women, and other communities that are marginalized. So for example, the LGBTQI plus communities, the community of people who are disabled. Children is also a community where they are often marginalized and not even included in some of these big decisions that's being made or talks about what's happening when it comes to gender-based violence. So it's the unequal power relations tied to gender. The other aspects that I have to mention would be, this is, I think, for me, more especially that I see in my work, is the impact of trauma and how we know this so well, that hurt people hurt others. And we've seen that any person that abuses, we know that they have had some form of abuse in their life. It may not be the same type of abuse, but we know that all abusers have been abused. Though not all those that have been abused become abusers. There is a difference in that. So trauma also plays a very important role in why we are seeing when, for example, so many men or so much of femicide that's happening in our country, where women are being killed by people that they know, by their loved one, by their family member, by their partners. And when we look at it, we see that the men who have, you know, perpetrated this terrible violence, they themselves have trauma that has been unresolved. Multi-generational trauma in South Africa has been passed on from one generation to the next and has not been dealt with. And so that becomes one of the key drivers as well, together with the gender inequality. We also then do see things that exacerbate these things of gender-based violence. So for example, we know that because of poverty, because of addiction, because of unhealthy relationships, these things, it all contributes to gender-based violence.
The unequal power relations stood out for me, and I wonder, look, we don't necessarily need to go into this now, but just thinking of the history of our country in terms of race dynamics, I think particularly that there were a time where white people, for example, really put down people from other races, and so there was the lack of power in those dynamics. People would go home, and I wonder, I mean, maybe you can speak to that, like whether home space felt like a place where, in a violent way, there was this, I can establish power in this space, and so it plays out negatively because so much power had been taken away in other places. Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. And we see this when someone has been oppressed in general. And if that oppression or that trauma that people have been a part of in our South African history, we know, for example, that many men in workspaces have been, in terms of our apartheid and racism history, black men had to bear the brunt of the unequal power dynamics. And in that relationship between the racism and apartheid, when they then did have to go home, there was a repercussion of all the things that they were carrying. And not everybody had the positive examples on how to deal with some of the unhealthy ways in which they internalized this harmful power dynamics. And so when it came to their families and their children, it was taken out on them. And we often see it even now in families, when adults, whether it's men or women, who are unable to regulate their emotions, their thoughts in a way of controlling and choosing to deal with their anger, deal with their shame, deal with the guilt, deal with the hurt and pain in responsible ways. And sometimes, like you said, you know, it's learned behavior. It's because what was done to them, or it's what they saw, or it's the examples of people that they saw around them of how do you deal with anger? No, you just slap your wife, or you just slap your child. And because that's the way they were brought up, and because that's the way they may have experienced it. So absolutely, this part that you are speaking of where people have been in some ways internalized the harmful values, the harmful behavior, and then it's replicated and the cycle continues again, like I said, from one generation to the next, it's passed on until, you know, somebody says, I will choose differently. I will unlearn that and I will learn a new way.
So Marisha, from what you just said, I think there's such an important thing. All these contributing factors, you're talking about being able to understand. Because there are these power dynamics, because there's this impact of trauma, we can understand why in various situations men and maybe other people might respond the way they do. So we're not affirming it, we're not accepting it, we're not saying it's okay. But I think it is key that we can start to see that there are patterns emerging and that in those situations, the likelihood is far greater because of the impact of these things. And I think as you were speaking as well, there was another element that you spoke of that I use the word overwhelming a lot, just because it does feel like that. And hopefully we're going to move towards some solutions, some ideas, some getting past it. But you were speaking about how poverty affects it and racism affects it and all these family situations, like everything seems to kind of impact it in different ways. And it's almost that question of the cart before the horse. If we could sort out poverty, would gender-based violence stop? Or do we need to sort out gender-based violence and then does poverty stop? That whole kind of thing where there's so many factors at play. And we know as part of Heartlines that research has shown that one of the biggest contributors to patterns of violence and abuse can be traced to fatherlessness. So maybe there is an element in that, like not having a positive male caregiver in one's life. And that might be one of the chief keys to latch onto in terms of when we start talking about solutions and working in a positive direction. Can you expand on that idea?
Yes, absolutely. And before I expand on that idea, I want to just add on to and affirm what you said about, even though there are these contributing factors, there's no excuses for gender-based violence. So while there may be, you know, systems that are in some ways helping the violence continue, when it comes to the choices that are made, it still comes down to the responsibility and accountability of each and every person of what they are choosing to do. So thank you for just mentioning that. And that's why it's so important, I think, you know, for us to be able to see it in this way of each person firstly thinking about how they can be a safe person in doing this work of ending gender-based violence. And when I'm saying that, I will link it to what you have pointed out so importantly, is that we've had throughout, I think, our many years of our country, our history, the issue where many of our children grow up without the active, positive presence of a biological dad or male figure in their lives. And in many ways, this has meant that it has put our children and it's put our families at high risk for many of the issues that also contribute to gender-based violence. So mental illness or mental health issues because of not having a positive, active presence of father, the more likelihood for addictions and substance abuse, for teenage pregnancy, for poor educational outcomes and economic outcomes as well. There's a variety of repercussions of what happens when we don't have an active positive presence of a father or of a male figure in the lives of children. It also, in some ways, put them at a high risk for becoming perpetrators of violence or even victim of violence as well. And so, yes, again, that word of overwhelming, an overwhelming majority of children in South Africa have that fatherlessness. And so at the same point, I want to say, look, this high risk doesn't mean that kids who have grown up in a space where there's been a single mom or raised by a granny or even by aunts, because many children, you know, have grown up and flourished and done well, not to be put at risk. But we have seen that when we also have an active positive presence of a father, it allows for there to be so much more of a healthy personhood of the child, of the family. They are able to be less at risk for many of the things that I mentioned earlier. The benefits that they get in them doing well at school, in having stable relationships, in having good attachment, it makes all of that so much more better. And historically as well, we've not acknowledged that fathers have an important role to play, especially in the first 1,000 days of a child's life. where they build bonding and attachment. And it's very important at that stage because it sets a person up, sets your relationships and what the likelihood would be for success and failure in that first 1,000 days. And so it becomes so important to recognize that having a positive, active presence of a father, of a man, even if it's not a biological father, of a social father, becomes key in bringing down the rates of gender-based violence, but also for also some of the other harmful aspects that many of our children face in South Africa today.
Thanks, Marisha. You mentioned that almost tagline for us. It would be an easy thing, I think, for you and me to rush past it when you speak about active, positive presence of men in the lives of children. And yet it's something we can't take for granted. I liked how you kept going back to that. A lot of people might think, oh, we just need dads in the space. It's not just that. We need it to be a positive presence. We need it to be an active presence. And where there aren't fathers for whatever reasons, we talk about having men in those spaces. So at Heartlines, we like to speak about social fathers or father figures. And the phrase that kept coming to mind while you were speaking was that idea, we had that African proverb, a village raises a child. We can maybe take that a little bit further. A village protects a child, safeguards a child, restores a child. And I think in the community, and you started to kind of touch on that, that it's not just one person, it's as community together. As a country, we're going into the 16 days where we try to kind of shine a spotlight on it so that more people can be aware, can start to be doing things. As we collectively start working on this stuff, that is when we're going to see healing and we're going to see movement forward. And then you push on that responsibility and accountability of each individual person, that we can understand maybe why you arrived in the situation, but we can't condone if your behavior is negative, if it is perpetrating, if it is causing violence. And so these things have to be held kind of likely next to each other. And these are journeys that I think we have to make together. One of the key aspects that comes up again and again when it comes to gender-based violence is this thing of fear being a powerful silencer. Survivors often face the stigma from their communities, or maybe we've heard stories about disbelief from authorities and sometimes even threats from their abusers, especially when you have a power dynamic, when it's somebody maybe in a marriage or when there's a business at play. So how do we start to create environments where survivors feel safe to break their silence, especially maybe when they've heard stories of other people doing so and it hasn't gone so well?
That's such an important question, because the silencing for many victims and survivors remain a very real thing for them, because they know that firstly, they won't be believed. That's one of the things that keep many victims silent. And if they do mention it, they are often blamed for it. So this aspect of creating a safer, and I'll say safer instead of safe, because the reality is many spaces can never be fully safe. But we want to make sure that it's safer, and then a courageous one as well. So there's two parts to this. There's that we need the safer container for people to be able to share their pain, share what has happened to them. And then there's also the courage aspect. And I think the courage, I would say in some ways, you know, lies as well, not just with the survivors and victims, but in spaces that are supposed to be safer, but are not being courageous enough in saying, we will create a space for survivors to share what is happening with them. And I think of faith spaces. Often faith spaces are big silences. And it's often the first space that survivors want to go and seek help, but it's the last place that they often receive it. And so the safer spaces and the more courageous spaces needs to happen by both the places where survivors are part of, and then for survivors also to then take the courage to say, I've heard that it can be really bad. I heard and seen that it can, but continue not to give up hope. There are many spaces now that are becoming more aware that we need to be a safer space, that we need to be able to provide a place where survivors and victims can come and share what has happened to them. But it does take a little courage from survivors to be able to do that. But it's also not responsible for us to ask survivors to speak up if we know, for example, whether it's faith spaces, whether it's our healthcare spaces, whether it's our care centers, that we are not doing the job of creating that container of safety. So again, I will go back to first saying, are you a safer person? It will always need to be that we start with ourselves in whatever spaces we're finding ourselves in, whether it is the faith space, a corporate space, the healthcare space, the legal and justice systems, that we ourselves start to see, what are the ways in my own life, in my own values, that I am in some ways have not helped in allowing for more safer space? Maybe it's been my attitude. Maybe it's been the ways in which I've held on to certain values of concerning gender-based violence. And to really interrogate those, to look at what are my values? What are my beliefs? How has that affected my attitude and behavior? That will definitely in some ways help us then to say, okay, I am now understanding it. Even the language that I use, even if a victim or survivor comes, for example, if you are hijacked, we would say, sorry that that happened to you. But in no way do we say, oh, you know, why were you driving there? Or what car were you driving? Or why did you go there? But we often do that to victims. Why were you there? What were you wearing? It's really so different. So it starts definitely with each of us understanding how can we be a safer person in whatever space we find ourselves in. It needs for us to destigmatize some of the things in which we have been talking about gender-based violence and how we talk about survivors. And then to really listen, even if you don't have the answers in whatever space, but to provide a space where you will say, I will listen, I will hear you out. That becomes so important. And then to affirm and validate once someone shares their story, once someone is able to disclose, this has happened to me, to believe them, to validate them, to affirm them in saying, thank you for sharing this. It must have taken so much of courage. It must have been so hard. So these are just important things to do. There's a lot of things we don't have control over when it comes to systems, but people make up systems. And if we can start with each person saying, I want to be a safer person, what are some of the things that I need to unlearn? And what are some of the life-sustaining, life-affirming things that I need to learn, then let me do that.
So much jumped out for me while you were talking there, Marisha, and I just want to thank you for sharing so personally. I mean, this is, I don't want to gloss over the fact that at the start of this conversation, you spoke or you mentioned, you declared vulnerably that you are a survivor. You were a victim of gender-based violence. And even the fact that we're having this conversation, there must be stuff that I think has to be brought up for you. There must be a risk, there's a cost, there's a pain for you to be able to speak about this stuff. And so I really value just the vulnerability with which you've shared. But really this last part about starting to empower people, people that are listening and going, oh, these are the things I can control. These are the things I can do. Because many people might not feel equipped with a topic as heavy as this to be able to save the world. But what can you do? And being somebody that shows up, and I think posture is really important. You spoke about active listening and you used the phrase really listen. And I love that because sometimes we will invite people to share a story and we won't be listening. Or we'll be thinking of the next thing that we're going to say. You made it so easy, even if you don't have answers, like you really equipped people that are listening that really do want to be allies, that do want to get involved, that do want to help. Like you've really made it easy for us to go, oh, actually, I can listen and I can affirm somebody that tells me a story. That is very easy in one sense. I mean, it's not easy listening to somebody's story about these kind of things, but it is a way that I can show up. And I think that's so valuable with a topic like this as we head toward the 16 days of activism. Again, it just feels like something that is big and out there and there's systems and structures. But here's a way for me as an individual, and you've said it a number of times, show up, start with yourself. I think you said this idea of looking at the mirror. And I loved how you pitched, are you a safer person? Like none of us can presume that we are safe, but am I a safer person? And is there something I need to do? I think you spoke about your attitude. How can I show up in a way? I'm thinking of guys standing around the braai and telling jokes and telling stories and certain of them will have a posture where you're just not going to listen at all. It's like that person is not a safe space. They've identified, they've shown, they've demonstrated that they are not going to be the person I speak to. And I think for us, it's like, how can we be the opposite of that? How can we step in when people are saying negative things and say, that's not okay? How can we push back to the jokes and the things like that? And so I think that's what we've got to sit with. And for me, am I a safer person? again, we go back to that active positive presence. How do I show up in a space? Demonstrating vulnerability. And what I've seen in various Heartlines workshops when I lead, when we're doing What's Your Story, and I've opened a workshop sharing about the last 3 years of my life and my divorce and the end of my marriage. And it was this traumatic thing that happened to me, the three hardest years in my life, that when I've opened up with a story like that, it has really, in a sense, given other people permission to share some of their stories that maybe feel the same level of hecticness or maybe don't feel as hectic. And I think especially with this stuff, and again, as I said, with you having this conversation with us, you are somebody that has walked that road. And so there's such a deep affirmation, a welcoming, an invitation to say, I made it through this. Another question that we didn't really discuss before, but that's been playing on my mind the whole time. You've mentioned both victims and survivors as the same person. So I think you've identified you are a victim, you are a survivor. Those words are quite different. The one feels like, I guess it's a power thing or a control thing. A victim feels like somebody had this thing done to them and that's the end of the story. But when you talk about surviving and then surviving as a person who's now speaking into the space, you're working in the space, you are doing things that mean other people will stop doing it or other people will be protected or heard. Is there anything in the label that sparks significance for you?
Thank you, Brett. I mean, there's so many things that you mentioned now, and thank you for the affirmation or just acknowledging. I think that's exactly what I'm saying, you know, that we should do, is that when someone declares, is to acknowledge them. The thing is, when survivors share, it makes a whole lot of people really uncomfortable. It does do that. And because of that uncomfortableness, and even in the faith space, if you think about a church, sex and sexuality and power dynamics is quite taboo topics. You don't talk about it. So even for survivors wanting to declare what has happened to them, you know, they are silenced so much by it because these are not things we would normally talk about in many spaces. But the more we are able to allow victims and survivors to share their stories and for us to really listen to that. And like you said, not listening to respond, but really just listening to understand. It does allow then others, giving them permission to be vulnerable, to say, I can take the courage and take that first step and declare what has happened. Because for myself, I see it in this way that you really can't heal what you don't reveal. The things that have hurt you, whether you reveal it to yourself or others, it has to be revealed in some way so that you can start healing from it. And that's a very tough thing to do when we don't always have the spaces that would welcome us or welcome one to share and say, I'm listening, I understand, I acknowledge, I affirm. So do really thank you for that. The other aspect is this whole aspect about victims and survivors. And I think it's important, again, like with language, to use whatever the person that has been hurt. Because for many of them, they do feel like they're a victim because they have never gained justice for what has happened to them. And some people would want to continue to use the word victim because of that. And then some people who are on their healing journey may say, no, I don't want to be called a victim anymore. What happened to me in that particular time, I was victimized, but I choose to now see that I survived it. I worked through it. I have gone through the most horrendous, horrific experience, but I did everything in my power to survive. So I'm a survivor, and to also acknowledge and affirm that. And it is quite different for people in their different experiences. But like you said, to acknowledge and affirm how they have gone through their experiences. If they are saying, you know, I still feel like a victim because of where I'm at, because of the justice I've never gotten, then that's the word they may use, or if they see themselves as a survivor as well. So that's quite important as well.
So Marisha, as you've mentioned, and I think we've alluded to, there are organizations and hotlines and support groups to help survivors navigate their journey. Could you perhaps mention some of those, just help us to find the places where we can get help? And then when it comes to offering psychosocial support, how do we build that for communities that don't have access to those services?
So access to support becomes key for many survivors. And then also, I think for perpetrators as well, when they're at a position where they can say, I've done wrong and I need help. I would say that for survivors, the Gender-Based Violence National Hotline, this is something that even if you do not have the funds, or you can even send an SMS, which is *120*7867, and you will get a call back. So that's definitely one place. Another space for support is FAMHSA, which is a family crisis. We also have Childline, a space that works with children that are facing abuse. There is the Faith Action to End Gender-Based Violence Collective, and you can get in touch with the Faith Action through programs at www.sosa.org.za. And there's SADC. If people are needing psychosocial support, if people are depressed, if people are suicidal. So there's many different spaces that people can reach out. There's the National Shelter Movement of South Africa, and they have a 24-hour toll-free helpline, which is 0800-001-005. And they also have an SMS or WhatsApp or please call me. So you could also look at the National Shelter Movement of South Africa. It's not only providing shelter, but they can put you in touch with many different places of where you need psychosocial support, whether you need accommodation, if you are in need throughout the country. The other ones that I would say spaces where there isn't, this is where it's so important to know that there are also Tutuzela care centers in all 9 provinces. And unfortunately, you know, in some rural areas, it may not be close by, but if you do look up Tutuzela care centers, we do have them throughout the country. And it's kind of your one-stop place for anything related to gender-based violence. So if somebody has been raped or hurt, if they need to get medical care, if they need to get psychosocial support, that a Tutuzela care center is a space for them to go. Lifeline is another space that people could also reach out to. But I also want to talk towards when there's absolutely nothing in certain spaces. And this is where the faith sector becomes so important. And at the Faith Action to End Gender-Based Violence Collective, and We Will Speak Out South Africa, is working towards helping in this way. While we may not have, for example, a clinic or even a police station or a healthcare facility or even a psychologist or social worker, almost in every community in South Africa, there is a faith space. And whether it's rural or whether it's urban, we have faith spaces throughout the country, and we want to make sure that faith spaces become safer for both victims and families that are being affected by gender-based violence, and then also for perpetrators that need help, so that there can be a restorative justice process as well. And so faith spaces can become key in being able to see how they can come alongside and support survivors. If faith spaces need more help in terms of training, in terms of faith leaders needing a way to, how do I support survivors? How do I speak to a perpetrator? Then definitely to reach out to the Faith Action to End Gender-Based Violence Collective, or We Will Speak Out South Africa, and they can help, because we have faith communities almost in every little village, in big towns throughout the country as well.
Marisha, I love how you just started listing things and just kept going. Like, that's exciting. That's affirming. That's like, there are a lot of people involved in organizations and places and spaces that really are trying to make an impact. I think that is one of the keys as we come up to the 16 days of activism, because I know a lot of people are like, oh, 365 days of activism. But if it's happening all the time, it's easy to forget about it, or it's easy for it to be pushed into the background. And so I think this time every year that it becomes front and center. So we're not saying only care about this stuff for 16 days, but we're saying let's shine a light on the work that is being done, on the stories that are happening. And it's so exciting just hear you listing all of those different places that there really is help for people in every kind of situation. The Tutuzela care centers is the one that jumped out at me, but you've mentioned and named so many different places and ways, and then the importance of faith spaces, as you say, like those really do touch every part of the country, and so we need to do the work to make sure those are safer spaces. But it is encouraging to know that with this thing being such a scourge, that there are lots of people, the army is growing, the people who are stepping in and stepping alongside and presenting themselves and volunteering, that number is growing, and that's super encouraging. And I think just as we say goodbye to you, let me offer you a couple of things to speak into and just share whatever's on your heart. But do you have a message to victims of gender-based violence, as somebody that carries that as part of your story? And then maybe what I really liked when you were listing those things, you mentioned perpetrators of violence, because we can have this idea of, oh, just throw them to the side, they're done. And I know for both you and myself, we believe in the redemption of every person. So do you have have any final words to maybe say to somebody who's listening who might be a perpetrator of violence? And then I think you've already answered this question, but if you've got anything to add to those of us who want to create a meaningful change in eradicating GBV, maybe one next step for your average person like myself.
So let me first say to victims or survivors, you are not alone. And for them to really truly understand that when something so horrendous happens to you, you may feel and believe that no one will get or understand what has happened or why it has happened, or will they even believe you? And I want to say that you have people who are willing to journey with you, who themselves have been hurt as well, and want to say that there's hope. There can be a way of healing. There can be a way where you can gain back who you are, things that have been robbed and taken away, that you can find a life that is not where you're just surviving, but where you are thriving and where you are flourishing once again, and to never give up hope in that, because it is possible. Yes, it's hard work, but a healing journey is so possible. It does take courage to say, I need to step up and step out of some of the things that have really killed me in some ways. And how do I make that life-giving again? How do I let that grow again? And so I want to say that's definitely possible. I've spoken to perpetrators as well. And for many, yes, there are some who we would say, you know, have deep-seated psychological issues where you may think there can never be any help or redemption for them because of what they've done and because of they don't know how to stop doing what they do. And then there are everyday kind of perpetrators who I would say our fathers, our brothers, our husbands, our sons, who have been ingrained in some ways with such harmful ways of thinking about masculinity and what it is to be a man, or how it is to be a boy, not to cry, or, you know, boys will be boys, believe them kind of thing. You know, they do these things to them. I would say, you know, there's a way to unlearn those harmful practices that you've been indoctrinated with, that you've been so socialized with, and you haven't even realized, oh my gosh, I am doing that, or I've internalized that, because you just think that it's normal to be that way. And so it does take, again, courage to say, you know, I don't want to be like this. I want to change when I think about how it is to treat a woman with love and respect and care, and to unlearn some of these harmful stereotypes that I have been ingrained with. And for then perpetrators who really do need more intense psychosocial behavioral work, there's also help for you. There's definitely things that can be done, from cognitive behavioral therapy to different tools that can be used to help you really stop. In some ways, it's like working with addiction. There's steps and there's processes. But again, it's hard work, and it takes a lot of courage to admit I've done wrong, and to be able to say, I am willing, and making a choice to say, I want to be different and I want to do this differently. And then for people, like you're saying, Brett, for yourself, who are on a journey of unlearning some of the ways, and this is a thing I'd like for us to consider, that at some time in our life, we all have been either victims, survivors, perpetrators, or bystanders of gender-based violence. And now that might be like, oh, you know, you're saying that I've done that. Yes, because we live in a system and in spaces where we've been socialized to believe certain things, that women are less than, that the girl child should be like this, girls should be virgins, and boys can have many partners as they want to. So all of these unhealthy things that we all have held on to, in some ways have contributed to us being victims, survivors, perpetrators, and then bystanders. But I think what all of us can then move toward is being an upstander. An upstander means speaking out. Like you're saying, when you see something, say something about it. Whether it's those harmful jokes, whether it's on a WhatsApp chat, whether it's around the braai. For example, a woman walking down the street and men catcalling her, you know, and you are part of that group, or mentioning something about a woman or something that's demeaning. to stop it right there and then, to call it out, to be an upstander and say, that's not acceptable, and not while I'm here, not in my presence. Those are the personal ways, but practical ways, like you're saying, volunteer, but there's many different campaigns that one can get involved in. A simple one now that's happening during the 16 days of activism is called the Red Chair Campaign. And it simply means wherever you are, whether at home, whether it's in your church space, your faith space, organization, whether you're at work or at school, it's to say, please, can I place a red chair or a chair, and can I put a red cloth over it? And you say a place for them, or remembering victims of gender-based violence. Another initiative that's well known is Thursdays in Black. And it simply means wearing black on a Thursday. During apartheid, it was where some of the domestic workers, if they could get a day off, it would be a Thursday. So it's again standing in solidarity with survivors and victims. So you become involved in different ways. It happens even on social media. You know, it's a space where you could really also then use whatever is in your sphere of control, whether it's social media, whether it's time that you've been given to speak about something, to share something, and to put that in so that it becomes meaningful and people are made more aware of what is going on in places that they can get help, whether it's a survivor or a perpetrator.
That is phenomenal. Thank you so much. When you brought in bystanders, I was like, oh, we could start a whole nother conversation right there. And then you spoke about being upstanders. So if you see something, say something. And so Marisha Singh Naika, you continue to be one of my favorite people that I don't get to spend enough time with. And so that has been another episode of In Conversation with Heartlines. And today was Beyond 16 Days, How to Make Meaningful Change in Eradicating GBV. And so as we've heard, ending GBV is not just a survivor's responsibility, it is all of ours. And so as a society, let's work on ourselves to be safer. Let's create these spaces where survivors feel empowered to speak out without fear, where we encourage our fathers and men and boys to step up as positive caregivers, as positive beings, and where we model healthy relationships to our children. Let's foster compassion, let's amplify voices, let's work for justice. And as we heard with the Red Chair campaign, with Thursdays in Black, there are ways that seem small but can start conversations, can really invite other people in. Various organizations around the country are going to be doing things for 16 days of activism. Let's find something that we could plug in, and together we can dismantle the systems that perpetuate violence.
And that's it for today. We hope we've left you inspired as we learn and grow together. To continue this conversation and to connect with more values-based content, visit our website at www.heartlines.org.za. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube at Heartlines ZA.